From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Few issues prompt debate in America like the environment. Last week on Capitol Hill, it was all about the 32-year-old legislation that has nurtured the bald eagle and the spotted owl.
The Endangered Species Act is a law with good intentions, but it has spun wildly out of control with tragic consequences for average Americans.
What is a fish without a river? What is a bird without a tree to nest in? What is an Endangered Species Act without any enforcement mechanism to assure that their habitat is protected? It is nothing.
Last Thursday, the House voted 229 to 193 to profoundly change the landmark Endangered Species Act, ushered in back in 1973. Supporters of the new House bill say it protects property owners, who for years have borne the brunt of the Act's protections. Critics charge the new bill guts the heart of the Act itself, leaving vulnerable species at the mercy of an anti-environmental administration and inevitable human greed. This hour on Point, America's Endangered Species Act and its own survival. We turn first to Washington and Michael Doyle, Washington correspondent for the Sacramento and Fresno Bee newspapers. He's been closely following an overhaul championed by California Republicans. Michael Doyle, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
So we do have, by any standard here, major changes in the Endangered Species Act. This has only passed the House, not the Senate, and that's another story you'll tell us about. But first, describe for us the changes that would be wrought by this House bill if it were put into effect.
Well, there are 74 pages that make up this bill, and they attack or address every component of the underlying Endangered Species Act. The controversy really centers on three components. One involves the elimination of what's called a critical habitat protections. One is a new mandatory compensation program for property owners whose land is restricted in its use.
Right.
And the third is a restriction in the level of protections for threatened as opposed to endangered species. In brief essence, this proposed package of amendments would protect property owners, repay them if they lose use of their land, and somewhat restrict the protections for existing species.
And so they're very happy about it, including your congressman out there, Richard Pombo, who has a California Republican who's fought for this for a decade and more. Of course, environmentalists saying this would gut the Endangered Species Act. Let's look at these elements. First, on critical habitat. This, I guess everyone has heard about this over the years. It's what sets aside large acreage of land, often private land, to protect species that are there, whether they're bald eagles or spotted owls or tiger salamanders. Is that right?
Well, that's right. This is land that's deemed to be essential for the survival and recovery of the vulnerable species. The Mr. Pombo, the congressman who's pushing this bill, and the Bush administration maintain that critical habitat per se does nothing to protect species, and instead it's a cumbersome process. They want to replace that with what they call recovery habitat. The gist of this would be recovery habitat would be smaller, more narrowly focused, and there would be fewer requirements on the federal government for actions that take place on that land.
And it would essentially let the landowners go ahead and develop a whole lot more than they've been able to under the Endangered Species Act as it's been laid out.
Well, it doesn't go quite that far. There would be less land set aside, but
mm-hmm.
these are not refuges. There would be fewer protections under recovery habitat, but there would still be requirements that government agencies consult and possibly take mitigating action.
And when the government does step in and says, no, we can't do development here, the big change there is private landowners would have to be compensated at full market value for their lost development opportunity, as I understand it, under this legislation. Is that right?
Well, that's right, and that's a huge element of this bill, and it has even the Bush administration raising some red flags. The Bush administration, on the day the House approved this bill, came out in support of the overall bill, but cautioned very strongly that this compensation program, the first of its kind, could be hugely expensive. And indeed, the Congressional Budget Office's estimates are that it could contribute to a doubling in the overall Endangered Species Act costs. So there are the Interior Department as well as environmentalists raises concerns about these mandatory fair market payments, and that's going to be one of the real obstacles to getting a final bill passed through the Senate.
Very, very expensive. You quote Representative Jim McGovern, Democrat in Massachusetts, calling it an endless slush fund for developers. Richard Pombo, the California congressman, has been very strong in pushing for this for a long time. Who is he? What's his background?
Well, Richard Pombo is now a seasoned member of the leadership in the Congress, but when he came to Congress in 1993, he was a 31-year-old rancher and a former member of the Tracy City Council from the Central Valley of California. He was a cowboy hat wearing, cowboy boot wearing a young man who was extremely angry at the Endangered Species Act's impingement, as he saw it, on private property. Over the course of time, he's pushed until now without success to reform, as he puts it, the law. He's a man of strong beliefs and considerable persistence.
And a lot of attention focused in his realm and others on property rights. Of course, this is just the House bill that's passed. It hasn't gone through the Senate. What are the prospects as it moves toward the Senate, Michael Doyle?
Well, it's going to be tough in the Senate. The Lincoln Chafee is a Rhode Island Republican of moderate inclinations and but much more a green state and much friendlier and sympathetic toward the environmental community.
And what is Senator Chafee's sway here on this particular front?
Well, he's the chairman of the Senate subcommittee that oversees the Endangered Species Act. What Senator Chafee has done, first, he has not embraced the House bill. He has asked a group of arbitrators in Colorado to help bring together the warring parties, and by January or February, the Senate may have something to look at. Asked the odds, I would say 50-50.
50-50, exactly what? That they'll initiate any change in the Endangered Species Act, or that they'll embrace the House version?
Oh, they will not. There will not be an embrace of the House version, except insofar as is necessary to change it. There are certainly members of the Senate who, like Mr. Pombo, want to change the Endangered Species Act. Senator Chafee is not going to want to do exactly what Congressman Pombo is proposing. I think the odds are 50-50 that the Senate will pass its own bill and the House and Senate can negotiate their differences. You have to understand, this has been going on for literally more than a decade, and the chances of any one congressman able to resolve it are iffy. But having said that, getting the bill through the House, first time in a decade that the conservatives have been able to do that, does show some success on their and some momentum on their part.
And finally, Michael Doyle, we heard in the bit of tape there Congressman Jay Inslee, Democrat, Washington, saying, "What is a fish without a river?" We hear the celebration among the property rights advocates. How loud has the lamentation been among the environmental crowd?
Well, there's weeping and moaning and gnashing of teeth. There's considerable anxiety among the mainstream environmental groups that these revisions are going to, as they typically put it, gut the intent and consequences of the act. There is movement by mainstream Democrats to embrace some changes, and there are negotiations that have taken place with Democrats. But at the rhetorical level right now, Congressman Inslee's quote that you played certainly captured the passions involved.
Some change, but not, they say, this change. Michael Doyle, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael Doyle, Washington correspondent for the Sacramento and Fresno Bee newspapers. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking this hour about the future of the Endangered Species Act. You can join the conversation. Have you followed the huge battle over the act in Washington? Do you see progress or retreat in the bill passed last week by the House? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Columbus, Ohio, is Andrew Wetzler, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, a nationwide environmental action organization. Andrew Wetzler, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, I'm joined by Brian Kennedy. He's communications director for the House Committee on Resources, and with Republican Chairman Richard Pombo, has played a major role in the passage of the Threatened and Endangered Species Recovery Act, the new legislation. Brian Kennedy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Tom.
Brian Kennedy, first to you. This is a triumph for Congressman Pombo, and for what interest? What has won in the House in the last week?
Well, I think what you saw between the vote on final passage and the vote on a substitute amendment on the House floor was overwhelming support for updating and modernizing the Endangered Species Act. And certainly, as Mike Doyle pointed out, that is a huge victory.
Overwhelming support, 229 to 190-something, it's not exactly a hands-down victory.
Well, when you take a look at what the substitute amendment was, a overhaul in itself, it did a lot of the same things that Chairman Pombo's underlying bill did. For example, it required tougher scientific standards. It eliminated the designation of critical habitat.
And this is the so-called alternate view for overhaul put forward by more Democrats, yeah.
That is correct. So when you take a look at that, between final passage and the substitute amendment, 415 out of 435 members of the House voted to change the Endangered Species Act and update it for the 21st century.
Andrew Wetzler, we've just got a half minute before a break here, but who's won and what's lost in the House in the last week?
Well, there's an enormous amount lost, and I think Michael pointed out a lot of the significant weakenings of the Endangered Species Act that would result if this bill became law. One thing he forgot is an enormous exemption for the pesticide industry, exempting the pesticide industry from major provisions of the Endangered Species Act that was a part of this bill, which is a huge deal.
Roll over Rachel Carson.
Exactly, exactly. And it was, as you point out, a very close vote. And we did much, much better in the House than we thought we would, and there's a lot of... It's clear that there's an overwhelming support by the public for the Endangered Species Act, and there's a significant amount of opposition in Washington to rolling back the Endangered Species Act, which is what this legislation would do.
Do you see a gutted act if this goes forward in the Senate?
Absolutely.
We'll come back and look at exactly the details of this. Brian Kennedy is with us. Andrew Wetzler from the Natural Resources Defense Council. You can join us as well. Have you followed this battle over the Endangered Species Act? Do you see that act's own survival at stake here, or a whole new way for a whole new century? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's premier environmental legislation, the Endangered Species Act, and whether and how it's going to survive an overhaul on Capitol Hill. You can join the conversation, Do You See Progress, or a gutted act in the bill passed last week by the House, and can ironclad property rights live side by side with animal rights, with the right to live? Were we too strict, too sweeping in the original 1973 Act? Was it too tough on landowners? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about all kinds of well-known and less well-known species protected here. The Florida panther, the manatee, grizzly bear, wolf, condor, bald eagle. And then you've got your fairy shrimp and tiger salamander and famously snail darter and spotted owl and a whole lot more. We're joined in this hour by Andrew Wetzler, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He joins us from Columbus, Ohio. And by Brian Kennedy, joining us from Washington, communications director for the House Committee on Resources, serving under Republican Chairman Richard Pombo, who has sponsored and worked a long time to turn over some major provisions of the Endangered Species Act. And last week, in the House at least, he succeeded. Andrew Wetzler, take us back and remind us of the fundamentals of this act when it was promulgated in 1973. How big a deal was it? What did it actually protect? And go to this. What even Democrats are saying there were some changes needed here. What turned out to work well and what not so well in the Endangered Species Act over years?
Well, the Endangered Species Act is one of our landmark environmental laws, and it's interesting to note that it was signed by a Republican president, Richard Nixon, and it was passed overwhelmingly by Congress. There was only 4 dissenting votes in the House of Representatives, and the act was approved unanimously in the Senate.
How times change.
It really is a sign of how times change. But the framers of the act recognized that the wildlife and fish and plants, which are part of America, are our children's natural heritage, and that we owe it to future generations to protect them. And the Endangered Species Act is one of our most basic safety nets, and it's been an incredibly successful act. 98% of the species protected under the act are still alive today, like the bald eagle, as you pointed out. Mm. And the longer a species is protected by the Endangered Species Act, the more likely it is to be classified by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as either stable or improving.
And on the downside, even Democrats were saying we've got to make some changes here. What emerged as problems with the act over time?
Well, the conservation community, of course, believes that any law can be improved, although certainly not the way Mr. Pombo has proposed. One of the things, for instance, that could be done to improve the law is to provide more incentives to landowners to care for the wildlife on their land. Now, that's not the same thing as paying people not to kill wildlife, which is essentially what this bill would do, paying people not to pollute. Rather, people who go above and beyond the requirements of the law, who want to set aside extra habitat on their land, who want to take special care of the creatures that live on their land, those people should be entitled to grant programs and to some sort of financial incentives. That's something that the conservation community has long supported. We also believe that the recovery plan provisions of the Endangered Species Act need to be strengthened and that deadlines need to be imposed on the preparation of recovery plans.
Brian Kennedy, your crowd has been extremely critical of the same act that Andrew Wetzler lauds here. Why so critical? It seems to have kept a lot of species from extinction, or at least they haven't gone extinct while it's been in effect. That should count for something, no?
Well, we don't really know that. The proponents of the current Endangered Species Act will use terms like 98 or 99% successful, but the goal of the Endangered Species Act is to conserve and recover endangered species. In its 33 years of implementation, the Act has recovered 10 or less than 1% of its 1,300 species. That's not a very good successful number after three decades of this law.
But are you and most you concerned with it working better or with property rights being more strongly defended?
I beg your pardon?
Are you most concerned with it working better in terms of species health or with property rights being defended? What's your number one priority here?
Chairman Pombo is interested in making this law work to recover species and coexist with private property owners in a better way. To date, it has not recovered endangered species, and it has caused a tremendous amount of conflict with private property owners. The chairman believes that if we are going to increase those numbers for species recovery, that private property owners have to be part of the program. They have to be the partner of the federal government instead of the victim of a very, you know, heavy-handed regulations from Washington.
So describe what's been won here, in your view, Brian Kennedy, in the House.
A number of things. In this legislation, some of the unintended consequences of the 1973 Act have been corrected. Private property owners will see the removal of real disincentives and have them replaced by incentives to work with the federal government. And from a constitutional standpoint, when property is taken, as according to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, they will be compensated for the taking of private property. So I think we're going to see, when this becomes law, a bill that actually works with much less conflict with folks on the ground who matter most, and those are the private property owners.
Andrew Wetzler, what do you make of this critique and the proposal here? I mean, will this work, just work differently, or will it not work, and why? And what about the fundamental issue of compensating property owners when their development rights might be impeded by protecting wild species?
Well, I'll talk about the development rights in a second, but first I just want to address the comment that Brian made about the recovery rate of species under the Act, which is really misleading and unfair. The fact is that on average, if you take the average endangered species protected by the Endangered Species Act, that species has only been on the Act for an average of 15 years.
Okay.
And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will tell you itself, if you look at recovery plans, that the average species needs between 30 and 50 years to recover. So claiming that the Endangered Species Act is a failure because of a low recovery rate is a bit like walking into a hospital and saying, oh my God, there must be something wrong with this hospital. Look at all these sick people.
So why do you think that claim is being made, Andrew Wetzler?
Because it's politically convenient for Mr. Pombo and Mr. Kennedy, because they want to cast the Endangered Species Act as a failure. But notice the rhetoric they use. They talk about modernizing and updating and strengthening the Endangered Species Act because public opinion polls show that the act is overwhelmingly popular. But if you had invited Mr. Kennedy onto this show 2 years ago, you would have heard a very different story. He would have said that the Endangered Species Act is broken, that it's a failure, that it prioritizes insignificant creatures like snails over people. That rhetoric doesn't work, but that rhetoric does reveal the true intentions of the authors of this bill.
Oh.
Now, as
If I may, just to let listeners know, we're talking about the Endangered Species Act and whether and how it's going to survive an overhaul on Capitol Hill. The House voted last week 229 to 193 for a major overhaul. Property rights advocates are celebrating. Environmentalists are calling it a gutting of the bill. Kieran Suckling, head of the Center for Biological Diversity, says this bill sends conservation back to the Stone Age. Andrew Wetzler with the Natural Resources Defense Council, how exactly? Why? What's the environmentalist critique of why this won't work?
Well, it would, as Michael pointed out, it's a 74-page bill, and it would take me the entire show to point out everything that was wrong with it. But the top three highlights, or lowlights, as it will, are first, the complete elimination of the critical habitat protections from the Endangered Species Act, which is the principal way that the Endangered Species Act protects the place where plants, fish, and wildlife live. Second, an enormous exemption for the pesticide industry that I mentioned earlier under the Endangered Species Act completely exempts regulation by the EPA of pesticides from the major protection provision of the Endangered Species Act that applies to federal agencies, the so-called consultation provisions. And third, the creation of an enormous entitlement program that is going to take tens of millions of dollars away out of the Fish and Wildlife Service's budget and instead funnel it, these taxpayer dollars, into the pockets of big developers and oil and gas companies and other folks in exchange for those industries agreeing not to kill endangered species on their land. And that violates a fundamental premise of American environmental law, which is that we do not pay people in this country not to pollute. Fish, wildlife, and plants, no less than the water we drink or the air we breathe, is a common resource. And just like a landowner does not have the right to pollute the air, or to pollute the water, they don't have a right to kill endangered species on their land.
But if this legislation goes ahead through the Senate, that appears unlikely. But if it should, exactly that precedent would be set. Listeners, you can join our conversation. Do you see progress or a gutted act in the bill passed last week by the House? And can ironclad property rights live side by side with animal rights, with the right to live? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Brian Kennedy in Washington with the House Committee on Resources. That's Richard Pombo's committee there. And Andrew Wetzler, please stand by. Joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Sheila Olmsted, Professor of Environmental Economics at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Sheila Olmsted, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
How do you hear this debate as an academic looking on? Diametrically opposite claims made here about the Endangered Species Act, that it's a success, that it's a failure. Have there been unintended consequences that need addressing, and is this quote-unquote overhaul the best way to address them?
Well, economists kind of look at endangered species preservation as what we call a classic public good, right? That all of us, you know, Americans benefit from the existence of the Act and that we have some value for the preservation of these animals and these plants. And, you know, to some extent, all of us bear the cost through taxes, you know, and the money that it takes to run the Fish and Wildlife Service and implement the legislation. But in general, also, there's sort of a very small but maybe growing number of private citizens that bear a pretty substantial cost, possibly in terms of the restrictions that the implementation of the legislation implies for their land uses and things like this.
They can't build a hotel or a strip mine there because the red-legged frog might go away.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, so we're sort of forced into this position under the Endangered Species Act. I mean, we use in my class, I always use National Public Radio, actually, as my example of the classic public good, and we have this problem, right? That
I hope we're not snail darters here.
You're not snail darters, but only a small number of listeners, you know, actually contribute, and maybe even their contributions don't reflect, you know, how much they truly value it because they know it will be around whether they contribute or not. And in the endangered species case, we actually have a slightly different and more awkward situation, right, which is that about 80 to 90% of identified endangered species populations in the United States reside on private land.
So inevitably, because most land is private.
Exactly. So we have these sort of awkward partners in the implementation of this, you know, very important piece of legislation. And I'm going to agree with Andrew that, you know, studies that have been done of American citizens' willingness to pay for the preservation of individual species do give us some pretty important numbers, and they do support, you know, this contention that Americans broadly support endangered species preservation of some kind. And then the question is, how is it that we're going to pay for, right, this act that gives benefits to all citizens, and, you know, is it
realistic? At the cost of a few. But Andrew Wetzler says that there's a fundamental principle here is that we do not pay people not to pollute, not to harm the environment.
Well, in some cases, that's true, but I will say it's not without precedent. I mean, we certainly have the Conservation Reserve Program under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We have the Grasslands Program. There are small private, very small-scale private programs. Defenders of Wildlife, for example, pays, you know, ranchers, or at least at one time did, for livestock loss to wolves from wolf reintroduction in parts of the American West. So, you know, it's not unprecedented. I will say that, you know, it's hard to, again, from an economist's perspective, I want to see the benefit-cost analysis that this bill read. I want to see whether really paying mandatory compensation of full market value, you know, to landowners is really worth it. Certainly there are other approaches that have been proposed, and certainly some of those have been proposed by Democrats and some by Republicans in the past.
Brian Kennedy, let me turn to you for a moment, if I may. How do you see the property rights argument here? Your ally, maybe boss there, Richard Pombo, the California congressman, his book is entitled This Land Is Your Land, which seems to leave out some of the rest of that formula of Woody Guthrie's song. But how do you see the, how do you describe the property rights argument over the Endangered Species Act?
Well, the chairman believes that the protection of private property rights is going to be the key to recovering endangered species. As was pointed out, 80 to 90%, maybe more, of the endangered species in the United States have habitat on private land. And we are not going to, in the chairman's opinion, increase the amount of successful recoveries and conservation stories that we have unless we remove the disincentives built into the law currently and replace them with real positive incentives and protections for the landowner.
That's cash, but let me ask you, why wouldn't the critical habitat restrictions on development work? On the face of it, if you set the land aside, essentially, it would seem that ought to protect the species.
I guess I don't understand your question. The way critical habitat is implemented right now, according to both Republican and Democrat administrations, it hasn't worked. The Fish and Wildlife Service, again, under successive administrations, has said that designating critical habitat statutorily does very little, if anything, to help the species. It's driven by litigation.
Andrew Wetzler said it's too soon to gauge that. It takes 30 or 50 years for species to come back. So we hear the debate there. How would this new legislation be more effective than setting aside? I mean, to a layman, if you set aside the land, that seems to suggest the endangered species is there unperturbed and it ought to have a chance at recovery. How would the new legislation perform that more effectively, Brian Kennedy?
Well, you're confusing a place with a process here. We are changing the process of identifying habitat in this process. Instead of it having it be the critical habitat designation process as is currently done in the law, the habitat will be identified and protected in the recovery planning process, because we do know from the Fish and Wildlife Service that the current way of designating habitat does not work.
Andrew Wetzler, just a different way to the same goal.
Well, that's just not true. First of all, critical habitat does work. Peer-reviewed studies have shown that species with designated critical habitat are twice as likely to be classified as either stable or improving. Now, that's a statistical correlation, which is different than causation, but it's a significant correlation, and correlation can tell you a lot. Second of all, the bill as proposed by Mr. Pombo that rewrite the Endangered Species Act only calls for the identification of special areas, which is an undefined term, in the recovery planning process, but then explicitly says that that the recovery plans create no regulatory authority and are effectively not binding on either the federal government or private landowners. So it takes the critical habitat designation process, which incidentally does not set land aside. It simply creates an extra safety net, an extra check-in with the Fish and Wildlife Service before that land can be altered. Turns it into a completely undefined, non-binding, non-regulatory mishmash that's going to do nothing to help endangered species.
Sheila Olmsted, you know, it's hard for a layperson to figure this out. Brian Kennedy's saying this is going to be more effective. Andrew Wetzler says, no way, that's just straight up wrong. I mean, you're an economist, so I don't know. Do you end up looking at whether the endangered species survive or thrive? I mean, is somebody lying here?
No, I don't. I think really we have two very, very different perspectives, right, and two very different value systems that are represented by the speakers on the show today. And I think, you know, certainly, as I said, Democrats have recognized for a long time that there are some weaknesses in terms of the incentives that are set up under the current structure, which are tend to be pretty perverse, right? If the private landowners are necessary partners, and what we've seen in some cases are some pretty high-profile instances of private landowners doing what's called shoot, shovel, and shut up, right? This idea that, God forbid, I should actually, you know, expand the species population on my property, or that someone should find out, for example, that I have an endangered species.
So get rid of them first and put up the development. We've got to take a short break here. Sheila Olmsted at Yale, Brian Kennedy in Washington, and Andrew Wessler in Columbus, Ohio. Please stand by. We're talking about America's premier environmental legislation, the Endangered Species Act, up for, well, it's called an overhaul. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's premier environmental legislation, the Endangered Species Act, and whether and how it's going to survive an overhaul on Capitol Hill. The House, last Thursday, by a vote of 229 to 193, passed, well, essentially legislation that would take the place of the Endangered Species Act. That now goes toward the Senate. Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, U.S. Senator, is at the head of the panel that will consider it. The thought is it probably is not likely to go straight through in the form it's in now, but clearly there is a lot in play here and very different interpretations of what's going on. You can join our conversation this hour. Do you see progress or a gutted act in the bill passed last week by the House? We've got the head of the Center for Biological Diversity saying the bill sends conservation back to the Stone Age. On the other hand, you have property rights advocates celebrating and say, oh, it will work better. We're joined in this hour by Sheila Olmsted, professor of environmental economics at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, by Brian Kennedy, communications director for the House Committee on Resources, serving under Republican Chairman Richard Pomba, who's been a strong advocate of the changes there, and from Columbus, Ohio, by Andrew Wetzler, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, director of the NRDC's Endangered Species Project. Right now, Athanasios is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, you're on the air, my friend.
Hi, thank you so much for letting me speak today. I'm really enjoying your program. It was in the car and I was listening, and the background of my comment is that it's extremely obvious. I just came back from a trip overseas to the country that I'm from and also to a different country in Europe.
Athanasios, is that Greece?
It's Greece. I'm mm-hmm. from Greece, yes.
All right. How did we guess?
How did you guess? The whole rest of the world seems to know that our climate is drastically changing and that we're really destroying our planet with the global warming, and that it is there are certainly man-made causes for this global warming. And one of the interesting things was that general sense in Greece and in Spain, which was the other country that I was in, is although there was an outpouring of sympathy for Katrina, they also kind of saw it as a poetic justice that the country that's contributing the most to global warming and to the destruction of our planet got hit by these hurricanes that are definitely due to global warming.
But take us to the Endangered Species Act. Brian Kennedy is saying today, look, if you acknowledge property owners' rights, that you're ultimately going to be more effective in dealing with the endangered species issue.
Well, giving that as the background, and what I think is that we need to do everything possible in order to protect as many species and protect our planet as much as possible. And so I think that property owners' rights come way, 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 way far down on the list in terms of that. We need to do as much as we can to protect our environment, and it's just obvious by the extreme changes that we've seen.
So species first and property rights well behind. Brian Kennedy, what do you say to that?
Well, as I said before, I think you have to have both. I think you have to use the private property owner to achieve the goal of protecting and recovering endangered species, and that unless you set up a mechanism where that private property owner is seen as a value added, and that private property owner sees the presence of a species on his land as a value added, you're not going to achieve that goal. And under current law, as has been said, we have shoot, shovel, and shut up. And that's not good for species any way you slice it.
And that's a shorthand way of saying go ahead and sort of cover up the species, kill them or develop right over them before anybody notices them, and you'll be better off. Let me ask you this, Brian Kennedy, is there enough money in the U.S. Treasury in the world to pay for all the property rights that might be infringed upon here by conservation concerns?
Absolutely, because we have so many built-in protections up front that the compensation issue is really the last resort.
But the White House itself is saying, watch out, this is a budget buster. Even as they supported the House bill, they were very clear with that concern.
Well,
if you're going to be paying landowners for every infringement.
Where the administration said that, the Congressional Budget Office said that this component alone will cost $10 million. Certainly we have that. What you're also seeing is, and has been stated, is that the Fish and Wildlife Service budget over several years will double. That was Chairman Pombo's intent. He has always said that if we make some common sense changes to make this law work, then he will put his money where his mouth is and increase the funding to recover endangered species. That's why you're seeing the total number almost double over the next 5 years.
So you're calling that,
compensation is only $10 million.
You're calling that enforcement money, not compensation money. Randy's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to welcome you to Eastern Iowa. We just started carrying your program, so thank you very much.
It's great to be with you. What do you think, Randy?
And my comment is I grew up a Republican, and it was precisely because of the environmental issue, as I saw the Republican Party moving more and more toward the corporate and private property stance and forsaking the national interest, I left the Republican Party and became a Democrat. However, I live here in Iowa in the district of one of the few Republican representatives in Congress, Representative Jim Leach,
yeah,
who voted against this destruction of the Endangered Species Act, and as long as he continues to hold that position, I will continue to vote for him, even though I'm a registered Democrat. He's one of the few Republicans who has this kind of orientation.
So you're with him, and you're skeptical of the property rights move here. Andy Witzler, how about it? Brian Kennedy says, look, at the end of the day, if you really care about these endangered species, put your money where your mouth is. Pay property owners for the protection of these species. It's likely to be more effective, and it's only going to cost $10 million in a year, I guess.
Well, it's not likely to be more effective, and it's important to see just how invidious this proposal is because what it leads directly from, there's a beeline from this proposal in the Endangered Species Act to all environmental laws and, in fact, all public safety, health and regulation laws. As I said before,
mm-hmm.
It's a basic principle in America that we don't pay people not to pollute. There's no difference between telling somebody who has a private landowner that you can kill endangered species on your property or we have to write you a check, then you can pollute the air or we have to write you a check, or you can pollute the water or you have to write you a check. The truth is that environmental laws, public health and safety laws, labor laws, civil rights laws always impose a disproportional cost on some people. But when we talk about private property rights, we need to keep in mind that there's no right to pollute. There has never been a right to pollute any more than there's a right to have your property rezoned from residential to industrial. There wasn't a right to pollute in American law ever. There's not a right to pollute in the English law that it derives from. And even ancient Roman law recognized that wildlife is a common pool resource, something held in common by the community. So as a fundamental matter, we have to be very, very cautious about these kind of proposals. Now, as for that $10 million figure, I think it's nonsense. It's going to be far, far higher than that. Previous estimates of similar programs have put the figure far higher in the past. And finally, when it comes to the phrase shoot, shovel, and shut up, that really kind of gets my hackles up. And the reason it does is because it's no different than saying, well, we shouldn't have clean water laws, because if you have clean water laws, then you're just sending people to dump their toxic waste down the drain and shut up.
And something you mentioned a couple of times, I wanted to clarify. You said that the pesticide industry is now would be exempted under this legislation. From what exactly?
Right now, the Federal Endangered Species Act requires that any time a federal agency takes an action that may affect an endangered species, and that includes the Environmental Protection Agency and its regulation of pesticides, it needs to stop and do a safety check with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and make sure that its action is not going to affect a species' survival or recovery. What the bill does is it completely exempts pesticide regulation by the EPA from that provision. And it's pesticides like DDT, which almost caused the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon and countless other species to go extinct. And it's pesticides like atrazine, which is one of the most widely used agricultural chemicals, which we know has reproductive effects on endangered species like sea turtles and fish.
Sheila Olmsted, we're looking to you as our third party in this debate. Even some Democrats said that there were some tweaks necessary, some changes that would be a good idea in the Endangered Species Act. We don't know what's going to come out of the Senate and what will ultimately come out of conference. What would you change? I mean, would you go as far as the Pombo bill here? Would you do something less, something in the middle? How would you look at what we lived with for 33 years?
Well, I guess I would say, you know, it's very hard to judge whether, you know, how beneficial the current act has been. We don't have a counterfactual. We don't know what would have happened to a number of species in the absence of the act. But as I mentioned, I suspect that Americans' values for what it brings to them are actually quite high. And again, studies of individual species have indicated that that's the case. So we, you know, want to be careful not to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater, that we, you know, the talk about elimination of critical habitat designation and restrictions in the level of protections for threatened species. These are the kinds of things that, you know, again, like I said, would be very hard to judge whether those things are really moving in the right direction or not without looking, again, I'm an economist, so looking at some numbers. And I suspect, you know, that they might not look so good in a benefit-cost framework. The idea of mandatory compensation, I sort of see as something that has probably been coming for a long time. As far as whether it would be efficient to go as far as the current bill does and actually reimburse folks for their, you know, full market value of their land, again, I suspect if you were to do an analysis, it would turn out that, you know, that the ideal thing to do would be something less than that. Otherwise, you, again, sort of screw up people's incentives in terms of, you know, their activities with respect to species. So,
but can we afford as a nation to compensate every property owner who has an endangered species on his or her property? Or does that, at some point, does the math there just make sure that we're going to start cutting species off because we can't afford to compensate everyone?
Well, this is the question, right, is whether, you know, not only do we worry about the benefits and costs of doing these actions, but we worry about a limited budget constraint. And I should say that fish and wildlife right now sort of suffers from that problem, right, that we have a lot of species that have been listed, but there are no funds to do the critical habitat designation. We have species that perhaps should be listed, but there's no funds to do the scientific analyses that are necessary to determine whether, in fact, that's the case. So we still, you know, we've always had this problem of a limited budget constraint, and the question, I think, is unresolved as to whether there's really enough money in the Treasury, but, you know, to cover the expenses of these things. And I think, again, it would depend on the degree of compensation that would be necessary to align the incentives of landowners and the regulators.
We're coming to last words here soon. Brian Kennedy, if this bill were to go through the full Congress as it's gone through the House, Representative Pombo has promoted here, look 20 years down the road or 50 years down the road. What's your picture? Do you see much more development of these private lands where endangered species are residing? Do you see endangered species doing better? Do you see them under housing developments and gone?
Oh, I think the development threat is really just a rhetorical term. I think it's one of the scare tactics that the hard left uses, and some of the beneficiaries of the status quo under this law use to prevent it from being updated. I think 20 years from now we see a law that is more effective at recovering species. It produces less conflict and less litigation. And we move the ball forward. I think it'll be a very positive change, and that's what the 106 co-sponsors of this legislation, both Republican and Democrat, see as well, and that's why we're going to get it through.
Andrew Wetzler, look that same 20, 30, 40 years down the road on the new path described in the legislation that passed in the House last week.
Well, luckily, I don't believe that this bill will become law. 34 Republicans opposed this bill. There were 94 members of Congress who signed a letter opposing this bill. And as Michael pointed out at the top of the hour, there's significant opposition to this bill in the Senate. If it were to become law, I don't think there's no doubt in my mind that there will be less habitat available to wildlife in this country. There will be less species like the bald eagle, like the grizzly bear, like the manatee that will be alive in this world for our children to enjoy. And so we need to do everything we can. We need to talk to our congressional representatives. We need to talk to our senators and defend the Endangered Species Act. Mm.
Peter's calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
My comment is to Mr. Kennedy. There is a disagreement in perspective on this issue, but the disagreement is you're characterizing it as a disagreement over how to save endangered species rather than a disagreement as to whether to save them. And there's no question that the purpose of the legislation is to save fewer endangered species and to increase property owners' gains from their land. And here you are arguing that it's actually a better way to save endangered species. I think that is so disingenuous. I don't know what's in this bill, but I know I can't trust you to tell me the truth. So one issue is your own problem of credibility, and the other is shame on you. Didn't your mother teach you not to lie?
Brian Kennedy, the caller says, fess up. Put your full motivations on the table. I'm sure it's not the first time you've heard that. What do you say?
That's really the problem with partisan politics. Unfortunately, we have people that just would paint someone's intentions as less than what they say they are. Chairman Pombo wants to make this law work in the best way possible.
But he wrote a whole book on the primacy of property rights. This land is your land. I mean, he does seem to put a pretty strong emphasis on that. How does that stack up?
He does. He is a very, very, very strong advocate of private property rights under the Constitution. At the same time, he believes that it's private property rights and the protection thereof that will lead to greater species recovery. He truly believes that, as do the other sponsors of this legislation. And to really have a caller come, you know, call up and say, liar, liar, pants on fire is just not that intelligent.
Andrew Wetzler, if you, or in the alternate bill that was put forward, then Democrats and some Republicans supporting would have gone less far, but would have made changes. We just got a minute here, but if you could tweak this without the same thoroughgoing change that's described in the bill as it passed last week, what would you change?
Well, of course, I'd be very suspicious of changing anything right now because the people who ultimately negotiate the final language will be Chairman Pombo in a room with senators, and that's a process that the conservation community doesn't have a lot of control over, and I think that we're justifiably suspicious of. But there are things that could be done to improve the Endangered Species Act. More incentives for landowners. Again, that's not paying people not to kill wildlife. It's giving people incentives like tax breaks who go above and beyond the law's requirements, making the preparation of recovery plans mandatory and attaching a deadline to it, and making sure that there's a recovery standard in the habitat and other protections in the Endangered Species Act. That is an agenda that the entire conservation community would come around, and that if that was an agenda that Representative Pombo would embrace, we could have a bill tomorrow. But he won't embrace that agenda because his fundamental agenda is not to strengthen the Endangered Species Act. As the last caller pointed out, it is to weaken the Endangered Species Act. That has been his track record. That has been what he's been advocating for all 13 years in Congress. And the sudden change in his rhetoric now is due more to polling than anything else.
He may not embrace that, but others may, and we'll be watching the process as it works its way through the Senate and back to conference committee. Andrew Wetzler at the Natural Resources Defense Council, I want to thank you for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
And Sheila Olmsted at Yale's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, Professor of Environmental Economics there. Sheila, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Brian Kennedy, Communications Director for the House Committee on Resources under Republican Chairman Richard Pombo. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.